Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, an alien invasion, the invasive plant that's taking over the foothills in northern Utah and what's being done to try to stop it. And speaking of invasions, deer ticks that carry Lyme disease are showing up more frequently in Utah. We'll find out why. Also, TV's Diesel Brothers by Fremont Island in the Great Salt Lake, upsetting some local conservation environmental groups. And after more than a century, the LDS Church and the Boy Scouts of America are parting ways. All that and more coming up on the show. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune public lands reporter Brian Maffley is with us. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Roger.
We've got news columnist Robert Gerke as well. Good morning and welcome, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
And also environment reporter Emma Penrod is in studio as well. Welcome and good morning.
Hey, good morning.
And you are invited to weigh in on the stories that we are covering today. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us at 801-355-8255. Brian Maffley, as I just said, an invasion is underway in the foothills around Salt Lake City and elsewhere along the Wasatch Front.
Yeah.
Spurge. Just the word makes it sound like something that you
Myrtle spurge.
Myrtle spurge.
There's a lot of spurge varieties of spurge.
Spurge. Well, it's an ornamental evergreen. Why is it taking over our foothills, Brian?
Well, one of the reasons is we're so late to tackle the problem. To let people know how I got interested in this is I'm in the foothills a lot, and I've been watching myrtle spurge, kind of pretty plant, just kind of creeping farther and farther up the sides of the hills. And a few weeks ago, I was riding up Dry Canyon, which is above the Huntsman Cancer Institute, and the bottom of the canyon is just covered with that plant now. And it's the beginning of a crisis.
Well, taking over the foothills, some people who are listening right now might say, who cares? Why should they care?
Yeah, I got a lot of that. just to get the background here, it is a plant that nurseries were selling as a water-wise plant that could do well in our arid gardens in the Southwest. It is native to an arid part of the world. You know, Eurasian, the part, you know, east of the Mediterranean Sea. Mm-hmm. And the thought was, well, here's a plant that could survive well in our gardens. Unfortunately, it survives too well. It has no natural predators or pathogens that will keep it in check. And so it was sold here for many years and put in people's gardens, and now it has now left those gardens and is all over the hillsides in Salt Lake County. And I've heard from the Forest Service that it's all over Davis, Utah, Weber counties as well, but Salt Lake is ground zero in all of this.
And it's essentially crowding out the native plants, disrupting the ecosystem of the foothills and other places where
it has amazingly efficient reproductive system. It blows up seeds out about this time of year. That's why the timing of our story was now. There's many efforts underway to pull it out of the ground. So a lot of the people I've talked to think it's kind of too little too late. But the weed pulls they're nice public events that help draw attention to this problem. It's very difficult to pull the plant up because they have these tap roots that go from, you know, many feet into the ground, and they exude this nasty white latex that will burn your skin and really damage your eyes if you get it in your eyes. Wow. So you know, they don't want to use herbicides on it because it's resistant to herbicide because it has a tough, leathery skin, and all the herbicides will kill the native plants you want. Right. So it's, you know, you got to do it the good old-fashioned way, and it's extremely difficult. And once you pull it out, there's so many seeds in the ground, they're long-lived seeds, they just start sprouting the next year. So you have to go back the next year and pull up the seedlings. And, you know, our colleague Erin Alberty wrote about her own personal battle.
Yeah.
At her home on Wasatch Drive.
Huh. Yeah. And you know, this stuff just grows right on top of other plants. You spoke with someone from the Utah Native Plant Society who says that it's so entrenched a problem that he didn't sound optimistic about it.
Not at all. Yeah, and this is Tony Frates of the Utah Native Plant Society. That group is extremely frustrated because they've been bringing attention to the problem for years and years, and it wasn't declared a official noxious weed by the state of Utah until last year. Which meant you could legally sell it in nurseries. And the idea that you're promoting it as some benefit to the environment was just, the irony of that really drove Tony kind of crazy.
Well, being promoted that way because it is drought tolerant, but exceptionally so, it seems
Very much so. That taproot really helps. But that taproot, making it drought tolerant, also makes it really bad for holding soils together. So when you have your native non-invasive plants have a network of roots that hold hillsides intact, well, those plants are now getting crowded out. You pull up, and the myrtle spurge doesn't really hold the soils together. And then when you pull them out, now you've got a horrible risk of erosion. Mm-hmm. So this idea that some of the tweets I've been getting about me making a Tribune making a big deal out of this is it's arbitrary what plants get deemed noxious. There's nothing arbitrary about the noxiousness of this plant. Mm-hmm. It is extremely harmful to the environment, and it's just going to get exponentially worse.
I'm wondering, is there a sort of next myrtle spurge, or have northern Utah landscapers kind of gotten savvy? I mean, there's a lot of invasive species out there. You've got Russian olives that have taken over.
Planted deliberately.
Right.
Same with salt cedar and tamarisk. Those were planted to kind of hold stream banks together in the 30s, and now those plants have
choking streams.
They're choking the streams, yeah. And so we can see we have two types of invasives: some that we've deliberately planted, and then others that just kind of snuck in like cheatgrass. Mm-hmm. They got in somehow, and now they're all over the West. So what is the next myrtle spurge out there? I hope we can identify it and keep it out of our gardens ahead of time.
One lesson here is probably plant native plants.
Well, go with the natives, yeah.
Hey, Robert Gerke, just before we move on, any novel ideas on dealing with myrtle spurge?
With myrtle spurge? I guess a flamethrower doesn't work, right?
I don't know. Maybe that we ought to try that.
Yeah, it couldn't hurt. Myrtle Spurge was also my second grade teacher. I hope Miss Spurge is listening on it today. Sorry.
My band name, I'm sure. Yeah. Let's move from myrtle spurge onto other invasions. Emma Penrod, environment reporter, you wrote about the increase in Lyme disease that is happening in Utah. I used to live in Northern Virginia where there was a lot of Lyme disease, but when I came back home to Utah, I thought, hey, I'm safe. And, that relief came from the certain knowledge that we don't have Lyme disease here in Utah. My relief was apparently premature. Emma, tell us what's happening with Lyme disease.
Well, historically, Lyme disease has been a very rare thing in Utah. You usually had to. If Utahns got Lyme disease, it was probably because they had traveled elsewhere to an area where the ticks that carry the disease were present. But the ticks that carry the disease, they can't handle long, cold winters. It would kill off the younger ticks, and then they don't survive to the spring to reproduce. But with climate change, the average temperature in winter has been getting warmer. We've seen, recently several warmer winters here in Utah. And that has allowed these ticks to multiply more rapidly, both in Utah and elsewhere. So this has ultimately resulted in a 500% increase, according to the CDC, in the number of Lyme disease cases being reported in Utah.
Okay, a serious upward trend there. And this is, can we tie it to a specific vector? Can we say this is the Western black-legged tick that's doing this? This is the one that you pointed to.
Yeah. So normally you have, as you mentioned, the deer ticks that would carry Lyme disease. That's back east. Here in the West, we don't have that same species of tick. But on the West Coast, that black-legged tick, the Western black-legged tick, has been a problem and a vector for the disease. And that has been now detected in Utah.
What is, can we talk about, actually, just for a second, I don't mean to interrupt you, because you're talking about that species being able to survive here through the winter, overwintering because of milder winters as a result of climate change. But just before we lose sight of it, what is Lyme disease? What does it do to people? Can you talk about the symptoms and the effect on human health?
Yeah, it's usually initially characterized by a, you know, they call it a bullseye rash around the bite. And then over time, causes, you know, nerve damage, damage to the heart, you know, in some cases, severe cases, you know, requires a pacemaker. It can lead to, you know, chronic pain and issues with, you know, arthritis. And the issue with Lyme disease is if you catch it early and treat it early, you significantly decrease the chances of developing these chronic symptoms. But when it's not caught, and it can be difficult to catch because the symptoms are, you know, some, not everyone gets a rash. Some, you know, you get a very low grade fever, maybe some, you know, body aches, and then, you know, it appears to go away, and then until it progresses into these chronic symptoms that once they have become established, become much more difficult to treat, whereas it could be possibly cleared up by antibiotics early on if doctors catch it.
So difficult to diagnose, to know that you've got it. How can we, you know, I guess how worried should we be, Emma, and how should we protect ourselves against, you know, contracting Lyme disease? Tips and tricks to deal with it, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, so, one thing to keep in mind is that this 500% increase, the reason it's so large is because Utah at the beginning of, you know, in the 2000s, early 2000s, was only getting, you know, 2-3 cases a year, probably from people traveling outside the state. We're now up to, you know, dozen or so, which, you know, that's why it's still low. It's not a very, very high rate of incidence. It's just because we had so few before that the increase is so large. Most of those cases, the local health department thinks are, you know, being caused by out-of-state contact still. The Lyme disease itself hasn't been found in any of the ticks here, just the vector itself has been observed here. They're trying to get, you know, more monitoring efforts going so that we can keep a tab on that here in Utah. And you can't, you know, if the tick happens to get on you for a little while, that's not how you get Lyme disease. The tick has to be, you know, attached to you for quite a while. So if you, you know, after you've been outdoors, check yourself over, look for ticks and remove them, that would significantly decrease the odds of contracting the disease if you've been exposed.
Okay. Not to be an alarmist here, but there are also other diseases, other illnesses that are on the rise in Utah and that probably also have a climate change connection. In this same story, Emma, you wrote about these aren't tick-borne illnesses. These are diseases carried by mosquitoes. Maybe you can talk about the rise in things like West Nile virus as well.
Yeah, so the mosquito-borne illnesses remain the primary concern to the state health department. Especially, you know, if you have standing water in the area, that's where mosquitoes like to breed, and they like warm summers. So they like Utah. The issue is that we have new species of mosquitoes and new diseases, in some cases moving into, particularly in the southern parts of the state, as well as West Nile has been, you know, in recent years continuing to increase.
Brian Maffley or Robert Gerke, do you guys want to freak out with me about this? Should we find higher ground? What do we do?
Emma, a lot of people take their dogs up into the mountains. Do we have to worry about pets with this as well?
I haven't asked about pets, I have to be honest, but I do know that this is a concern in other states. So it's likely a concern here.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's worth pointing out, you know, this same issue with bark beetles is taking down whole entire forests in the Uintas is also related to climate change. I mean, the cold weather over the winter that once would take out most of the bark beetles, those winters don't happen very often. So you have these infestations have gotten really out of control, and climate change is a big problem, and apparently with the ticks. So I have frequently pulled ticks off my kids after hikes. And it's kind of, now it's kind of frightening. I'm going to probably take a closer lick.
All right.
Look.
Pay attention and read Emma Penrod's story for some additional information there.
And the CDC has been putting out a lot of good information as well recently about, you know, how to check yourself for ticks, you know, what to expect them to look like, as well as, you know, there's efforts right now to educate doctors to identify symptoms of these diseases that maybe previously, if you were a doctor in Utah, you wouldn't be looking for.
Right. You'd say that doesn't happen here and try and find some other reason for whatever the symptoms are.
On the pets thing, I do know West Nile is a problem for horses. And so, but there is a vaccine for horses. So I know that is a push that has gone out.
Okay. We will have we'll get to a few more environmental stories a little bit later on in the show. But first, we need to head to our first break of the show. And when we come back, the LDS Church and the Boy Scouts of America are parting ways. We will tackle that story when we return. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a minute.
Hey, this is Chris from Knoxville. Just wanted to call, leave a voicemail, and let you know how much I appreciate Bullseye. It's a show that really gets to the heart of things quickly.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, two brilliant singer-songwriters. I'll talk with Tao Wen of Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down, and Nico Case. That's on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Join us tomorrow afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
I'm blind in one eye. I knew this since I was a child, but I did not tell anyone till I was 12. In my defense, I thought it was normal to be able to see with just one eye. Just like you can write with your right hand, you can see with your right eye.
Join us next time for more true stories told live on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Join us tomorrow night at 6 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke, environment reporter Emma Penrod, and public lands reporter Brian Maffley. It is our Friday morning local news roundup. Join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, the LDS Church and the Boy Scouts of America have decided to take separate trails. They released a joint statement this week pointing to, I guess you could call it an amicable breakup, something that's been sort of a long time in the works for now. What's driving the decision for these two groups to part ways?
Well, I mean, there's been some tension between the two for quite some time because of what people refer to as the three G's, girls, gays, and godlessness. What Boy Scouts has been slowly kind of moving to be more inclusive. They've created female troops that are part of BSA rather than being, you know, Girl Scout troops. And they've allowed gay scout masters and obviously gay troop members. And so that's caused some heartburn among the church. I've also, you know, was told that the church has been kind of planning this separation for a long time. They pulled the varsity, they ended their involvement in the varsity scout program, which is for the older scouts. I think that was a year, maybe 2 years ago. And they've been working on putting together this young men's program that would be sort of like scouting, but also sort of have different components to it. So, and that gives them control over, you know, who they let in, what the teachings, what the program looks like. They can run their own program, and they have the ability to do that here. And as the church has said, it plans to do this globally. This program will be rolled out globally. So the big thing from the Scouts, Boy Scouts standpoint, is that in this state in particular, I mean, nationally, the church is not a huge part of it. I mean, it's significant, but here in this state, about 95% or more of the Scouts in the state are affiliated with the LDS Church. So that could be a big blow to the Scouts. I mean, the Scouts will still let LDS you know, people in to be part of the troop. But the question is, how many of them will stick around with, or will most of them go do this other church-oriented program?
You also wrote a column about this this separation this week, and you said that you view it essentially as a good thing for both organizations, that that they're parting ways at a time that makes sense for both of them.
Yeah, I mean, my initial gut instinct was that, well, this is kind of, you know, lousy for the church to be so, you know, dead set against incorporating these other groups. But really, I think maybe it gives the church an opportunity to have that sort of gospel-focused, religious-focused program that they said that they want to develop. And it also lets the scouts be the scouts. They can start operating the way that scout troops in the rest of the country operate, focused more on developing young men and this, you know, young women now as well, and not have to be sort of affiliated with this quasi-religious mission that they've had for in this state in particular for so long.
What about the fact that they're, you know, going forward, there may be scout troops without Mormon kids in them, where there were a lot of Mormon kids in them before? What I mean is that the program could help bridge divides between people of sort of distinct backgrounds. And if Mormon children are involved in this church program but not in scouts, that won't be happening, at least in scouting here. And maybe I'm putting asking too much of the scouts.
Well, I think it could still bridge the program, because I think a lot of Mormon kids are still going to be involved in scouting. It's just not going to be so overtly Mormon oriented, because, you know, I did some scouting when I was younger. I was not a good scout, but by any stretch of the imagination. But you know, you had your scout meetings at LDS wardhouses, and your scout master was called by the LDS bishop to be the scout master. It was very closely affiliated and closely aligned with the LDS church. Now, hypothetically, I guess, people from other faiths who want to be involved in it and maybe were uncomfortable with the close affiliation with the LDS church will feel more at home in scouting. LDS kids who want to continue to do scouting are going to continue to do scouting. They're just not going to have that sort of that omnipresent LDS influence, I think, on the scout thing. The hard part for the scouts here in this state, though, is because, as I mentioned, you had the buildings and you had the scoutmasters easily accessible, they're going to have to try to find new places to hold their scout meetings. They're going to have to work harder to get parents to volunteer to be scoutmasters if it's not a church calling. So that's going to present some challenges for them. But it's also going to, I think, make Boy Scouts kind of be a little more aggressive in their outreach and more inviting, I guess, to try to get people to come in. And one of the things that I think is really interesting for Boy Scouts in this state and elsewhere, I guess, is that they do have a lot of troops that are not affiliated with the LDS Church. There's a refugee troop that has hundreds of scouts in it. That not only incorporates or brings those refugees into scouting, it brings them into the community and starts fostering some connections there for those kids. And so I think, if that's the future of the Boy Scout program, I think that's why I said I think it could be a good thing for both parties.
Brian Maffley, Emma Penrod, just before we move on, you guys aren't columnists, but you both do environment reporting, and scouting has this sort of conservation ethic or history, or has from early on. Are there any comments here on the split from you guys before we move on to other stories? Robert Gerke says this is going to help both the Mormon Church and scouting itself.
Yeah, you know, I also was a scout, had a good one, like Robert, long time ago. And I think that's where I learned about conservation and the importance of treading lightly. And I would like to point out, though, I've heard many complaints as a reporter in Utah. I've been here for 20 plus years, that there, you know, that sometimes the Boy Scout troops aren't exhibiting the best in tread lightly when they're doing outings. I think I'm hoping, you know, the organization can, you know, this new organization affiliated with the church can really kind of hone into the importance of you know, keeping landscapes intact. You know? Maybe I shouldn't hold my breath there.
we'll wait and see, I guess. Emma Penrod, any comment from you on scouting in general?
Well, I'm a girl,
right.
So I was not involved in scouting because at the time they only allowed boys.
Right, well, this is one of the changes, though, right?
This is true, but I'm probably past that age. But one thing I have heard a lot, you know, from Mormon women and seen a lot of posts on Facebook and Twitter and on social media is kind of a collective rejoicing among Mormon women who appear to be largely glad that they will no longer have to be involved in these programs.
Be dead mothers and whatnot.
That's all I have from the, I guess, female side for now.
All right.
Yeah.
Brian Maffley, I want to just return to the public lands beat that you cover now.
Yeah.
And to a kind of unusual story, the purchase of an island in the Great Salt Lake, Fremont Island.
Wow, that came out of nowhere.
I know.
I'll tell you.
There's no segue here. I'm just jumping into an entirely different story. But this is island in the middle of the Great Salt Lake.
Well, it's not really in the middle of the Great Salt Lake. It's on the eastern shore, right off of Weber County. It's part of Weber County. And it's very large, 3,000 acres. It's the third largest after Stansbury and Antelope Islands. Unlike those two islands, though, it's not really connected to the mainland, right? You drive on these causeways to get to those two big islands. This one is difficult to access, especially when there's the water level is so low. These islands that are near the shores are now they're high and dry, so you can't take a boat out to them. So how I got wind of this. What was people I know in the conservation community had heard about this new entity called G&G Island was applying for access to the island. Well, it turns out they had purchased the island from some other owners. And when we looked into what G&G Island is, its main person involved was Dave Sparks, who's a famous name in our newsroom as the heavy D of the Diesel Brothers.
Right, TV's Diesel. They're famous. Here's a question for you, Brian, which is why was the island? Has the island always been private?
Yeah.
And just has been sold between entities for a long time.
Yeah, it was owned by one family for maybe 100 years before, and it was used for livestock grazing. And it was acquired by a group of people associated with the shrimping industry many, many years ago. And they haven't been able to really do much with it. They were a group known as Island Properties, LLC. And a lot of things didn't go right. There was a feral pig explosion that required the intervention of the Division of Wildlife Resources. Because the pigs, low water, the pigs were getting off the island, getting to Antelope Island, which is a state park just a few miles to the south of Fremont Island. And so a lot of people in the conservation community were kind of wondering, why can't the state buy that island, make it part of Antelope Island State Park? It could become good bird habitat again, like it probably was historically. But that apparently isn't happening now.
Will you remind listeners just who the Diesel Brothers are those?
We can bring Emma into this. She started writing about the Diesel Brothers first.
Emma Penrod?
Yeah.
Well, this is a reality show where some Utahns who, their business is they fix up trucks, they sell trucks. They have a reality show
cool t-shirts and boots, too.
Yes. And other trucks, all things trucks.
Yeah.
And they have also this reality show on which they fix up trucks and drive around in trucks. Again, all things trucks. And there was a local environmental group, the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, noticed in some of their videos that they were apparently participating in an activity known as rolling coal, which is where you modify the emissions systems on your diesel vehicle to emit large clouds of black visible pollution.
Right.
And they appeared to be possibly engaging in this in their show.
Highly illegal activity.
Yeah, it's not legal. So they sued the Utah Physicians, this group, to try to get them to stop. And that is working its way through the courts right now.
In the meantime, do the Diesel Brothers, still engage in that activity, I guess?
They say they do not.
Okay.
The show is still on. It's in its third season.
Fourth.
Fourth season now. So And for the most part, the Discovery Channel that hosts it has declined to comment for my stories.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the Diesel brothers is the sort of person behind this entity that bought Fremont Island. How much did it cost to buy the island? We don't know.
The land is assessed by Weber County at $900,000, but we don't know what the sale price is. And we also need to point out that. The lawyer for G&G Island says, you know, the Diesel brothers as an entity, as a TV show, is not involved in this transaction. What their plans for the island are very vague at this point. They're talking about, you know, eco-friendly, quote-unquote, recreation and maybe lodging on the island to make it a recreation venue. Now, does that mean heavy duty motorized recreation or hiking or what? We don't know. But I'm looking at, you know, Heavy D is he's an entrepreneur. I don't think he's going to drop $1 million to have a conservation landscape. I think they must have some ideas. And what's going to happen with the state of Utah, the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, has to decide what kind of access they're going to grant. How will they get to the island? What kind of equipment can they drive across the lake bed? Theoretically, I guess you could access the island by air, but that's you're not going to be able to get any motorized equipment there that way. You need to drive it.
So they've asked for an easement to access this island to drive across the dry lake.
And they're entitled to access by state law.
And you said the conservationists are none too happy about what's happening here.
Well, they just are. I think people, the Friends of Great Salt Lake and other groups, Audubon, I think they may have written off Fremont Island by now. I mean, feral pigs really can destroy a landscape. I think what they're more concerned about is what the lake bed is going to get hammered, is already getting hammered by kind of, you know, unauthorized motorized access, especially east of Antelope Island. It's very inviting to drive on the lake bed, I guess. And I guess their concern here is, you know, for G&G Island LLC to really take advantage of the island, they'll need to drive guests and equipment across the lake bed. And I think one of their concerns also is that it'll be a backdrop for the TV show. But at this point, they haven't even submitted a detailed proposal to Forestry, Fire, and State Land. So there's not much to really go on at this point.
We don't know what their plans are necessarily. I can't help but throw in a ghost story here, which...
You bet. I want to hear it,
which gets told around Halloween often, but Jean-Baptiste, the sextant of the city cemetery, here in Salt Lake City, who in 1862 was supposedly caught stealing burial clothes from corpses, grave robbing, essentially, and so he was banished to Fremont Island. And then he tried to apparently make an escape on a raft and may or may not have died in that attempt. And so I'm just putting it out there that the Diesel brothers may have just bought a haunted island.
Okay. Yeah. You were texting me about that, Roger. And I was sort of like, what are you talking about?
What is this thing you're talking about? Piece of history.
Well, it will be part of my future reporting.
Okay. Thanks.
Doubt.
Thanks for including that, Brian. Yeah. Much appreciated. Guys, we need to turn to another break, but we will return in a little bit and to a new public lands bill, an update on the trial of a conservationist accused of closing a corral gate in San Juan County, and the cuts planned at the Salt Lake Tribune. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and AARP Utah, a nonpartisan social change organization with a membership helping people 50 and over improve their lives by providing materials, programs, and advocacy on key issues. More information is available at aarp.org.
Did President Trump's hard line bring North Korea to the table? And will that strategy work on Iran now that the U.S. has left the nuclear deal? And a draft lyric for West Side Story that didn't work.
It's a sound like in church when they're praying. It kind of went thud.
Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 with Kirsten Swanson on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, it's Luke Burbank. This week on Livewire, comedian Katie Wynn on what it's really like when someone says something mean to you.
I am Tupperware and you are tomato sauce. Whatever you say becomes a part of me and ruins me forever.
That's this week on Livewire from PRI.
Join us tomorrow night.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Brian Maffley, staying with you, a few weeks back, you and I talked on this show about this case in San Juan County, the case of the closed cattle corral gate.
Yeah.
A couple closed a gate on a rancher's property. The rancher says they were trying to kill his cattle.
It wasn't the rancher's property.
Ah.
It was
public property. Yeah. Sure, yeah, public lands. Right, okay. So, but they closed off access for his cattle, apparently.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah. And he says that they were trying to kill his cattle. Felony charges have been brought. What's happening now?
Yeah. This is the you called it Felony Gate, which I thought was an amusing
Corral Gate. It sounds like gate. We're actually using gate right in a crime story, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, this is the person at the center of this is Rose Chilcote, who's a very unpopular figure in San Juan County because of her advocacy with Great Old Broads for Wilderness to keep motorized access out of Recapture Canyon, very popular ATV destination at one time.
Right.
She applauded and maybe even, you know, applied some pressure to the BLM to prosecute Phil Lyman, the county commissioner who led the protest ride there. You know, there's other things. Well, she's retired now from Great Old Broads, and one of the things she does is keep an eye on certain grazing allotments in San Juan County that are, and Zane O'Dell's is one. And so she and her husband, Mark Franklin, were on vacation. They live nearby in Durango, Colorado. So they were spending a weekend out there and keeping an eye on things on Zane O'Dell's allotment. And while they were visiting his notorious corral on Lime Ridge, Mark apparently closed the gate to the corral, and when Zane got wind of it and confronted them a couple days later, he basically accused them of attempting to murder his cattle by keeping them from a water source.
Right.
So it has resulted in felony charges against both Mark and Rose, and that after much pretrial wrangling and motions and all that, The judge in San Juan County has set a trial for May 23rd rejecting all of the defense motions. They've alleged that this is or complained that it's a politically motivated trial or prosecution. There's no evidence to support this. They want to bring in polygraph evidence of Mark showing that he
didn't
had no intentions of hurting the cows. All that was rejected. However, the judge did grant a change of venue to Carbon County, where not many people even heard of Great Old Broads or Rose Chilcote. So the trial will be in Price on May 23rd. It'll last for a couple days. But it is just, I've followed the case because it really shows how the public lands battles in our state have just gotten completely out of control.
I can't help. I'm sorry. Just for a quick moment, a bizarre sort of part of the case is someone who's being brought in by prosecutors, who's an expert witness, talking about the psychology of cows. And Brian, can you tell us about this?
That was one of the, well, there's so much paperwork's been filed in this case, and both sides have been disclosing their expert witnesses, and one is a extension specialist with Utah State University who's field of expertise, or one of his fields of expertise, is something called bovine psychology. And in the disclosure, it talked about how he will testify that the cow confronted by a closed gate looking for its water will just go back to the last place it had water and not try to find a way around the fence to get into the gate. Because this is the
Point
of the case is that the defense is trying to make is, hey, there was a break in the fence where Zane had breached the fence so he could access heavy equipment in there to drill a well. And so what's the big deal? The cows could come and go through the break in the fence. So I guess this expert witness is going to say, no, the cows are too stupid or creatures of habit to find that break in the fence.
To go investigating for holes in fences. Robert Gerke, this felony trial, this trial of these two people who closed this gate. By the way, Brian, when is this happening?
May 23rd in Price.
Okay, so just a couple weeks from now. What do you think of it?
Get your tickets now.
Gerke?
I mean, it seems like a pretty flimsy case that they've got, especially against Rose. She wasn't even present, apparently, when the gate was closed. And
well, they haven't proven. They have no evidence that she was, other than she's married to Mark.
Right.
And it was her vehicle that she that Mark was pictured.
But part of this is the perceived intent because of her involvement with conservation.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem with the case. Maybe Robert.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that we run into, I think, where we've seen happen over and over in southern Utah, in San Juan County in particular, is anybody who there's this divide between the conservationists and the good old boy rurals, and in this case, you have a prosecutor who seems to be. I mean, it certainly on the surface appears to be overzealous in charging, people with a number of felonies, maybe they did something wrong, but I'm not sure that this is, what is it, five felonies and
it's they charged Rose Chilko to the hilt, a second degree felony of attempted destruction of cattle. Third-degree felony of retaliating against a witness, and that was based on a complaint she filed against Zane O'Dell a few days later with the Bureau of Land Management, giving false information to a police officer because she identified herself as Rose Franklin and not Rose Chilcote. And trespassing on state lands. The corral is on state trust land section, and that's a Class A misdemeanor. So when you stacked it all up, it was, Rose was looking at a potential sentence of 21 years.
Yeah, and I think this part with the bovine psychologist is fascinating. I can't wait to hear what kind of testimony he has.
Right.
I'm not sure how you get a cow up on the couch to do the psychoanalysis you have to do. It sounds like a Far Side cartoon to me, but anyway.
Brian Maffley, before we turn to sort of our final segments of the show, I want to go to a story that you reported on later in the week, which is the introduction in Congress of a public lands bill.
Yeah.
This is by Representative John Curtis, Senator Orrin Hatch, for protection of lands in or designation of lands in Emory County.
In Emory County, this bill has been a long time coming, and it was it's kind of modeled after the bill that Senator Bennett had sponsored, resolving a lot of issues in Washington County. And the bill was put on hold to enable Rob Bishop's public lands initiative to move forward. And of course, that failed and is probably not coming back. And Emory County had participated in that, and I guess much to their disappointment. So now they've brushed off their old proposal and made some revisions. They're talking about 500,000 acres of wilderness designations around San Rafael Swell and along the Green River, establishing a national monument at Cleveland Lloyd, and then establishing a national conservation area around the core areas of the San Rafael Swell.
Right.
So, you put all these protections on, then you lift the WSA protection elsewhere, and move forward with, possible resource extraction on those lands. So the conservation community is kind of mixed on this bill. Some have endorsed it. Others, like Sue and the Sierra Club, have completely denounced it. Mm-hmm. They see it as a big giveaway. And are going to try to get it heavily amended during the markup in committees.
Okay. Again, we'll see what happens there. I mean, it has to make its way through Congress. It's been introduced. Do we know? Does it have a hearing yet?
I think that's those haven't been set. I'm expecting a hearing fairly soon in Rob Bishop's Natural Resources Committee, which he chairs.
Okay. Yeah. Robert Gerke, comments on this?
The devil's always in the details with these bills, and while there are some things that are probably good and that I think that, you know, all sides are supportive of. There's some problems that need to be worked out with it. And I also have I'm pretty skeptical that this will go anywhere, just because we're getting close to election time. Congress has a hard time passing legislation anyway, it turns out. Orrin Hatch wants this done as sort of a going away, one last thing to put on his resume, I guess. But it seems pretty unlikely that it's going to get much traction or get enough traction that it can fly through the both houses.
Some beloved places, though. I mean, San Rafael Swell, areas of paleontological richness as well, if I'm not mistaken, Brian.
That's right. And one of the big problems that SUA, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, sees, I've learned from their legislative director, is that these areas proposed for wilderness have kind of controversial routes cherry-stemmed into the wilderness areas. And they feel that, if you're allowing motorized access into the wilderness area through these cherry stems, aren't you defeating the whole purpose of even designating wilderness? And so that's probably the biggest red flag for them. There's also some issues with how the National Conservation Area would be governed. Apparently, it's not clear whether they're going to be able to really manage it for conservation.
Yeah, they always have a lot of latitude. BLM has a lot of latitude with how they manage national conservation areas, and so it really kind of national conservation areas can become recreation areas pretty easily just based
plans,
on management.
On how the management plan is designed.
Yeah.
Well, something to keep an eye on, and we will. We'll look to your reporting, Brian, for more updates on this.
Yeah, I hope.
I don't want to leave this conversation without getting some kind of reaction and alluding to what you're just saying right there, to the announcement made this week by Salt Lake Tribune publisher Paul Huntsman, in which he announced that cuts were coming for the paper, some layoffs. This is, he says, because of declining advertising revenue, shrinking circulation, and Robert Gerke, do we have any sense of what to expect yet?
I think we were going to have Emma to handle this one, but she's been laid off. So
no.
I'm kidding. She hasn't been. I was a joke. I'm sorry. She's still here. Gallows humor. That's all we've got left these days.
My heart stopped beating there.
That's not really funny.
Not funny. So we don't really know the scope of the layoffs. Let me start by saying I think that everybody knows the newspaper industry is in bad shape, and I think we've been, to Paul Huntsman's credit, and not just to praise my boss here, he's put a lot of his own money into trying to sustain the Tribune, to try to improve the Tribune over the 2 years he's owned it. But I think we all knew that it was losing money and that it probably couldn't go on forever. I'm not sure anybody was anticipating that we would be hit with this news this week, that there's going to be layoffs. We don't know how broad the layoffs are going to be. And it's unfortunate, you know, that the print circulation has declined precipitously just even in the last 2 years. We're down to just over 30,000 paid subscribers, print subscribers. The paywall that was put up has done okay, better than they expected, but you know, that's not going to offset the losses. So to try to keep this thing afloat. Mr. Huntsman told us last week that we're going to be seeing some cuts. Probably, he said, within the next week or two. And it's unfortunate because I think, you know, to plug my own employer, like my own newspaper, I guess, I think the Tribune is sort of the front line of, you know, holding governments accountable. It's important, I think, for informing the public. I think our sports writers do a great job in covering the games and providing the insight and the nuance to some of that. So that's going to suffer, and there's just no way around that.
Well, reporters, you know, who have developed a lot of sources, who are working on stories and bringing that, bringing awareness to stories that we might not otherwise have, and who have developed an expertise. It's tough to see any of that go. We don't know again any of the specifics.
Yeah, there's that old hackneyed cliche that, you know, we need to do more with less, and I'd like to punch those people in the face because they just don't. You can't do more with less. You reach a point where you do less with less.
You know, interestingly, there are staffers from the Denver Post who have been protesting in D.C. in New York at the headquarters of Alden Global Capital, which is the previous owner of the Salt Lake Tribune, mm-hmm. through Digital First Media, from whom Paul Huntsman bought the paper the idea being to bring some greater stability, but it's not, I guess, the investment that that they had hoped for.
Well, I mean, Paul bought the paper 2 years ago. His father had been trying for years to buy it. They put quite a bit of money into it up front. I mean, with the website redesign, that's not cheap. They filled some positions that had been vacant for a long time, and that costs money. They were doing advertising for the first time in years. There were raises given when he first came in. But I think maybe there was some optimism there that wasn't borne out by the business model. Unfortunate. It's going to be heartbreaking to lose some of these just really solid reporters, and it's, you know, but again, you mentioned the Denver Post. I mean, and the Ogden Standard Examiner, closer to home, recently laid off 5 people. The Denver Post, the cuts were more significant. I think had the Huntsman's not purchased the Tribune from Alden Capital, we would be on that same path as the Denver Post, probably much sooner than we are now.
Okay. Our sympathy and best wishes to our Tribune partners and to the reporters there. And I don't know what else to say, guys. It's time to move to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. Who wants to get us started? Brian Maffley? Another terrible segue, but go ahead.
That was great. Our colleague Aaron Albury had this really funny story about two serial poachers getting sentenced to prison in Duchesne County. And this speaks to the old adage, if you're going to do one illegal thing at a time, because these guys apparently were both had a lot of issues with crime, which made it illegal for them to even possess a firearm, much less use it to shoot elk and deer without a hunting license. And so anyway, they're paying the price now.
Wasn't there a social media component too, where they were caught because of a Facebook post or something along those lines?
Oh, that's another adage is when you're doing illegal stuff, don't put it on social media. I think Aaron discovered that how they were able to catch or determine the location of one of them was a social media post that showed a particular mountain in the background with a stolen backhoe. And on Google Earth, this equipment is easily spotted. Sure. So they figured out where to go and serve the arrest warrant.
Great pick for underplayed story by Aaron Alberti. Let's go to Emma Penrod for your pick for underplayed story, Emma.
Well, Aaron has another story up on the site this morning about Chinese Americans traveling to Utah to participate in the celebration of the joining or the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. There were a lot of Chinese Americans who were a part of the construction of that railroad. But historically, you know, its depiction, when we recreate it, has been involved a lot more white people. And so they have been celebrating this as a way to celebrate Chinese Americans' contributions to American history.
Yep, they were the Chinese who worked on that railroad, and especially the western half, were incredible workers, and that's. But even then, they were treated very badly.
149 years this year. Next year is the 150th anniversary of the Driving Golden Spike. Great pick, Emma Penrod. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
There was a trial that ended this week with the acquittal of 3 men who were accused of a pretty heinous crime. They were accused of raping this 9-year-old girl. They were acquitted. The jury found that they didn't prove that they did it. These guys had been locked up for quite some time. There was no apparent physical evidence that any crime had been committed, but the prosecutor still went ahead with the case and had these guys in behind bars for some time. And it's unfortunate that they had to serve time for a crime they didn't commit.
I'm gonna just forego my underplayed story of the week and say subscribe to your local paper, subscribe to their online subscriptions as well. I'm Roger McDonough. I've been joined by Robert Gerke, Emma Penrod, and Brian Maffley, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, guys, for being here.
Thank you,
Roger.
Thanks to everyone here at KCPW and Utah Public Radio who helped make the show possible. Again, I'm Roger McDonough. We will see you next week.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Utah Festival in Logan with Mozart's The Barber of Seville. Figaro the Barber knows all the town's secrets, full of funny tricks, mistaken identities, and familiar music. Full live orchestra, July 5th through August 3rd, details at utahfestival.org, and Cache Valley ENT and the Allergy Clinic, practicing ear, nose, and throat medicine, allergy services, and facial, plastic, and reconstructive surgery, and offering hearing aid services with audiologist Dr. Spencer Tijen, 753-7880.